Rusty Quill presents The Magnus Archives. Episode 7, The Piper.
Statement of Staff Sergeant Clarence Berry regarding his time serving with Wilfred Owen in the Great War. Original statement given November 6, 1922. Audio recording by Jonathan Sims, head archivist of the Magnus Institute, London. Statement begins. A lot of people call me lucky, you know. Not many came through the entirety of the war in one piece, and if you discount the burns, then I did indeed do just that. Even fewer spent all 4 years at the front, like I did. I was never sent for treatment, for shell shock or injury, and even my encounter with a German flamethrower only ended up with me in a frontline hospital at Wipers. I was still in that field hospital when the fighting started at the Somme, so I suppose that was lucky too. 4 years. Aye. Sometimes feel like I'm the only one who saw the whole damn show from start to finish, as though I alone know the Great War in all its awful glory. But deep down I know that honor, such as it is, has to go to Wilfred. You wouldn't have thought it from his poems, but all told his time at the front totaled not much over a year. Yet he got to know the war in a way I never did. He's certainly the only person I know that ever saw the Piper. I grew up poor, on the streets of Salford, so I joined the army as soon as I was old enough. I know you've heard the stories of brave lads signing up at 14, but this was before the war started, so there wasn't such a demand for manpower, and the recruiters were much more scrupulous about making sure those enlisting were of age. Even so, I was almost too skinny for them to take me, and barely made the required weight. But in the end I made it through, and after my training was assigned to the Manchester Regiment, 2nd Battalion, and it wasn't long before we were shipped off to France with the British Expeditionary Force. You seem like educated sorts, so I'm sure you read in the papers how that went. Soon enough, though, the trenches were dug and the boredom started to set in. Now, boredom is fine, understand, when the alternative are bombs, snipers, and gas attacks, but months at a time sitting in a waterlogged hole in the ground hoping your foot doesn't start swelling, well, it has a quiet terror all its own. Wilfred came to us in July of 1916. I'm not intimately familiar with his history, but he clearly came from stock good enough to be assigned as a probationary second lieutenant. I was a sergeant at the time, so had the job of giving him the sort of advice and support that a new officer needs from an NCO with 2 years of mud under his nails. That notwithstanding, I will admit to taking a dislike to the man when I first met him. He outranked me, and most of the others in the trench, in both military and social terms, and he seemed to treat the whole affair with an airy contempt. There's a sort of numbness that you adopt after months or years of bombing, a deliberate blankness which I think offended him. He was unfailingly polite, far more so than I was accustomed to in the Flanders mud, where the conversations, such as they were coarse and bleak. Yet under this politeness I could feel him dismiss out of hand any suggestion that I gave him or report that I made. It came as no surprise to me when he mentioned he wrote poetry. To be perfectly honest, I expected him to be dead within a week. To Wilfred's credit, he made it almost a year before anything horrendous happened to him. By the following spring, I'd venture to say that we might almost have been able to call each other friends. He'd been composing poetry during this time, of course, and occasionally would read it out to some of the men. They generally enjoyed it, but personally I thought it was dreadful. There was an emptiness to it, and every time he tried to put the war into words, it just sounded trite, like there was no soul to what he had to say. He would often talk about his literary aspirations and how he longed to be remembered, to take what this war truly was and immortalize it. Were I prone to flights of fancy, I dare say I would call his words portentous. When he talked like that, he had an odd habit of trailing off in the middle of the conversation with a tilt of his head, as though his attention had been taken by a far-off sound. The spring thaw had just recently passed when it happened, and we were on the offensive. Our battalion was near Savvy Wood when the orders came down. We were to attack the Hindenburg Line. Our target was a trench on the west side of St. Quentin. It was a quiet march. Even at this stage, there was often still some excitement when the orders came down for action, even if it was usually stifled by that choking fear that you got when waiting for the whistle. Yet that morning, there was something different in the air, an oppressive dread. We'd made this attack before, and knew that the change from the valley exposed us to artillery fire. And artillery was always the scariest part of it for me. Bayonets you could dodge, bullets you could duck, even gas you could block out if you were lucky, but artillery? All you could do against artillery was pray. Even Wilfred felt it, I could tell. He was usually quite talkative before combat. Morbid, but always talkative. That morning he didn't say a word. I tried to talk with him, raise his spirits, as is a sergeant's duty, but he just held up his hand to quiet me, and turned his head to listen. At the time, I didn't know what it was he was hearing, but it kept him silent. Even when we crested the ridge and the rest of us tried to drown out the deafening thrum of artillery with our own charging cry, even then he made no sound. The ground shook with the impact of the mortar shells, and I ran from foxhole to crater to foxhole, keeping my head low to avoid the bullets. As I ran, I felt a shooting pain in my ankle and pitched forward into the mud. Looking down, I saw I'd been caught by a length of barbed wire, half hidden by the damp, upturned soil. I felt a surge of panic begin to overtake me and frantically tried to remove the wire from my leg, but only succeeded in getting my hand scratched up quite badly. I looked around desperately to see if there was anyone else nearby who could help. And there, not 20 yards in front of me, I saw Wilfred standing, his face blank, and his head swaying to some unheard rhythm. And then I did hear it, gently riding over the pulse of mortars and the rattle of guns and the moans of dying men, a faint, piping melody. I could not have told you whether it was bagpipes or panpipes or some instrument I had never heard before, but its whistling tune was unmistakable. It struck me with the deepest sadness and a gentle creeping fear. And in that moment I knew what was about to happen. I looked at Wilfred, and as our eyes met, I saw that he knew as well. I heard a single gunshot, much louder than any of the others somehow. And I saw him go stiff, his eyes wide. And then the mortar blast hit him. He was lost in an eruption of mud and earth. I had plenty of time to mourn him, lying in that dreadful hole until nightfall, when I could free my leg as quietly and gently as possible before crawling back to our trench. It was slow going. Every time a flare went up, I could only lay motionless and pray. But the good Lord saw fit to let me reach our line relatively unscathed. I was quickly bundled off to the field hospital, which was overburdened as always. They didn't have much in the way of medicine or staff to spare, and certainly no beds free, so they washed my wounds with iodine, bandaged them, and sent me on my way, told me to come back if I got gangrene. I did have a look around the place to see if I could find Wilfred, but there was no sign of him to be found anywhere. Asking around the trench, no one had seen him return among the wounded, so I began to reconcile myself to the fact that he was dead. He wasn't the first friend I'd lost to the Germans, nor even the first I'd seen die in front of me, but something about that strange music that I heard in the moments before that explosion lingered in my mind, and left me dwelling on Wilfred in many a quiet moment. It was probably about a week and a half later I heard shouting from the end of the trench. It was a scouting party, who had been reconnoitering the river that flowed near Savvy Wood. Apparently they had found a wounded officer lying in a shell hole there and brought him back. I made my way over and was astounded to see that it was Wilfred. His uniform was torn and burned. He was covered with blood, and his eyes had a distant, far-off expression to them. But he was most definitely alive. I rode with him back up to the field hospital, along with the corporal of the squad who had found him. Apparently he had been lying in that hole for days, ever since the battle. They'd found him there, half dead from dehydration and fatigue, covered in the gore of another soldier. Whatever shell had created the hole he'd ended up in had clearly annihilated some other poor soul, and it was in his gory remnants that Wilfred had lain for almost 2 weeks. I waited outside the hospital tent while he was being treated. The doctor came out shortly, a grave look on his face. He told me the lieutenant was physically unharmed, something I considered at the time nothing short of a miracle, but that he had one of the worst cases of shell shock the doctor had ever encountered, and would have to be shipped back to England for recuperation. I asked him if I could see him, and the doctor consented, though he warned me that Wilfred hadn't said a word since he'd been brought in. As soon as I stepped inside the medical tent, I was overwhelmed by the sweet scent of decaying flesh and the moans of pain and despair. The sharp smell of the disinfectant brought back unpleasant memories of chlorine gas attacks. Still, I eventually found my way over to Wilfred's bed, and sure enough, there he was, staring silently out at the world, though with an intensity that alarmed me. I followed his gaze to a bed nearby, and there I saw a private I didn't recognize. His forehead was slick with sweat, and his chest rose and fell quickly, then abruptly stopped. I realized with a start that a man had just died, and nobody had noticed except Wilfred. I tried to engage him in conversation, rattled off a few meaningless pleasantries. How are you doing, old man? Heard you had a bit of a close call, glad you found yourself a crump hole, all that sort of nonsense. None of it seemed to produce any reaction in him. And instead he turned to me, and after a long while he simply said, "I met the war." I told him that he certainly had. Not many walk away from something like that, and lying in that hole so long, surrounded by all that death, well, he had definitely met the war, and it was a rotten bloody business. But Wilfred just shook his head like I didn't understand. And to be honest, I was starting to feel like I didn't. And he told me again that he met the war. He said it was no taller than I was. It struck me that perhaps he was describing some dreadful mirage that had come upon him as he lay in that wretched place. And I asked him to tell me what the war looked like. I remember exactly what he said. He told me it had